Let me tell you about this story called Fatopia. This episode is a story called Fatopia by Adam Kadre. It's one of my favorite stories of all time, and I wanted to try to adapt it into a podcast format. What's unusual about this story is that it wasn't first released as a story. It's actually a computer game. It was released in the late 90s, and it's what they used to call text adventures. Now they call it interactive fiction. Basically, you make choices as you go along. But in the case of Fatopia, no matter what choices you made, each scene always ended the same way, and the ultimate outcome was always the same. So that made it easy to adapt into a more conventional story format. You'll notice that it's all in the second person because in the game you actually play as these characters. And that was part of the point of how it was designed, was that because you inhabit these people, it makes the events taking place seem that much more immediate and it would allow them to affect you in a way that a normal story doesn't. So the streamlining of this story has removed that element. I'm hoping that now that I'm putting in music and sound effects, I'm hoping that those will work as a kind of stand-in, and that the experience this gets across will be somewhat similar to what it's like to play the game. Of course, if you'd rather play the game, it's available at Adam Kadre's website, which is adamkadre.ac. And I give it my highest possible recommendation. It's fantastic. So I hope that this interpretation does some kind of justice to the original. Fatopia by Adam Kadre. Will you read me a story? Read you a story? What fun would that be? I've got a better idea. Let's tell a story together. Speeding down Montgomery Boulevard, the streetlights are bright. Unbearably bright. You have to squint as hard as you can to keep your retinas from bursting into flame. Welcome back to the land of the living, bud, Rob says. You planning to stick around for a while or you're gonna pass out again? Because one thing I've learned about chicks is that they actually don't like it when you pass out on them in the middle of getting it on, you hear me? So if that's like your plan, then I'm dropping you off and showing up solo, bro. You don't exactly remember where the day went, but as you listen to Rob rant on, bits of it start to float back to you. A day on the slopes, the brisk February wind against your face, polishing off a keg back at the lodge, those two girls you and Rob had hit it off with, the ones who'd given you their address in town. We should all get together sometime, they'd said. Of course, Rob insisted that by sometime they'd meant later tonight. You hadn't been so sure. But then you'd blacked out before you could argue the point. How Rob came to be driving your car, you're not exactly sure. Apparently, he couldn't wait till you were sober enough to drive it yourself. From the way he's weaving all over the road, he also apparently couldn't wait until he was sober enough to drive it. You ask Rob about his blood alcohol level, and he says, "Lower than yours, bud." Rob looks at the scrap of paper with the address on it as the two of you go screaming through an empty intersection. Oh man, it's a fake address! Ah, no wait, it's upside down. He turns the paper right side up. Ah, hey, they're right on Barlett Hill Road! You tell Rob to pull over.
Only reason I'd pull the car over is to let you out and keep on going, dude, Rob says. You look up. Hey, it's red, you say. Huh? Rob says. The light, you say. You know, red, as in stop. But you don't stop. You don't even slow down as you fly into the intersection, and the light stays an unmistakable red.
Red. You are Wendy Mackay, first girl on the red planet. When you signed up for this mission, you thought that you were going to be coming to a habitable colony. Habitable means you can live there. See, the orbiter was supposed to drop all the pieces of the colony. The power plant, the living quarters, the greenhouse, things like that, onto the planet's surface, packed in airbags which would bounce around and then open up once they were safely on the ground. Some of the airbags were supposed to hold big trucks which would be operated by remote control, dragging the pieces of the colony into their proper places. Your job was going to be to take a tour of the place and verify that everything was up and running. Verify means to make sure. Instead, something went wrong on the orbiter, and it blew up before it had a chance to drop off its payload. Pieces of the orbiter and the colony rained all over the landscape. So this has become a salvage mission. Your instruments indicate that there's at least one piece that's still functioning. Functioning means it's not broken. Your job is to find that piece, or pieces if there's more than one. So you climb down the ladder of your ship and step onto the surface of an alien world. The onboard computers selected this general area as the most likely place to find salvageable remains of what would have been the colony. Salvageable means you can save it. The battered, rust-red landscape stretches out before you in every direction, pitted and pockmarked and littered with boulders. You take a few steps, amazed at how the light gravity turns each step into a great bounding leap. You find what seems to be a piece of a bulldozer or some other sort of construction equipment. It's a set of wheels, each one bigger across than you are tall, wrapped in a tread like on an army tank. You can tell it landed with some force from the ring of debris that surrounds it in a perfect circle. As you continue to walk, you find first one geodesic panel, then another. When people make a dome out of simple polygons like triangles or hexagons, that's called geodesic. Soon the clear plastic panels are as plentiful as the rust-red boulders. This must be where the dome for the living quarters landed. Soon you find you're right. Scattered around you are the remains of what would have been home to the first wave of colonists. Most of the housing units have been reduced to unidentifiable splintered heaps, but there's one that seems to be intact. Intact means that it isn't so damaged that it's unusable. The entrance is partially obstructed. Obstructed means blocked, by debris, but you're small enough that you could probably squeeze through. That's part of what makes you the perfect person for this job, aside from your astronautical expertise. Astronautical doesn't really mean anything. I just made it up. You squeeze into the housing unit. Since no one ever moved into this unit, it's really nothing but an empty gray box, no bigger than your bedroom back home. These quarters weren't designed with anything but sleeping in mind. The first colonists were expected to take their meals in a central dining commons, and bathrooms were to be in a separate structure, with each one shared by a number of people. Still, you can't help but feel a twinge. This was going to be someone's home. The first thing they saw when they woke up, the place they looked forward to retreating to after a hard day doing research or exploring the planet's surface or helping to maintain the colony. There were going to be pictures on these walls, footprints on the floor. Now the only footprints left here will be yours. You leave the housing unit and keep exploring, finding the ruins of the power plant. The power plant is in substantially worse shape than the living quarters, and considering that those were completely wrecked, that's saying something. Though the fissionable materials were specially packaged to prevent them from exploding, the Geiger counter in your suit indicates that this area is still very radioactive. I'll explain that part later. For now, let's just say it's very dangerous and you should probably be moving along. Before long, you find the ruins of the greenhouse. The colonization plans called for a central dome, where plants designed to thrive in the harsh, lifeless soil of the red planet could be grown and used for food. Everywhere you look are broken containers that once held seed pods, and now contain nothing but cinders and ash. Among the shattered seed pod containers, you see one single undamaged one, and pick it up. The moment you touch the seed pod container, the clicking in your helmet stops. This is the only item you will be able to save. You return to your ship, gently placing the seed pod on the seat next to you. Then you rocket back into space, leaving the red planet in your wake. Before long, a familiar, cloud-streaked blue ball appears on your monitors. You're home again. But something goes terribly wrong. The heat shields hold up fine during re-entry, but the parachutes fail to open as you head for splashdown. And so you plummet at an incredible rate, the ocean growing closer and closer. You hear a splash, and then can hear only the whir of your computer. You get up and go into the hallway, just outside your office. Your guest Gabriel's room lies just ahead of you, the door wide open. You go into his room. You've managed to get good use out of the fourth bedroom, taking in an exchange student through the Tortalia World Youth Program. In exchange for you providing Gabriel with room and board, Allison is entitled to spend a year attending school and living with Gabriel's family in Paraguay when she's 18, should she choose to go. Whether Allie will have any inclination to visit Paraguay in 14 years is an open question. You walk up to the window and take a look outside and feel a bayonet slice through your heart. Allie is floating face down in the pool. It takes all the willpower you possess to take the stairs merely 5 at a time, instead of simply throwing yourself down the staircase. Your backyard isn't exactly sprawling, but it was more than big enough to accommodate the small swimming pool which Allison was never supposed to be allowed near, at least not until she learned to swim. Gabriel pokes his head outside to see what's the matter, and cries, "Rescue her from the pool! I will call the emergency!" You jump into the pool and in a matter of seconds have Allie safely on the cement bank. But she still isn't breathing. Gabriel comes dashing back outside, telephone in hand. "The ambulance is coming, and at the same time I have the instructions for the CPR. First, tilt her head back." You tilt her head back and Gabriel says, "Now you must breathe into her mouth." You breathe into Allie's mouth and Gabriel says, "Now you must press her chest." You apply pressure to Allie's chest and suddenly she coughs up a mouthful of water. A minute later, she's sitting up and looking around bewilderedly. "Allison," you cry, "Allison, baby, how many times have we told you not to go near the pool? Another minute, we would have lost you. You know you're not supposed to go near the pool." "I wanted to see," she says.
"What?"
"I wanted to see," she says, "if the world looked the same under the water as it does over it." Sea blue. Your spaceship was able to survive the impact with the ocean easily. You barely even felt the jolt.
Impact is what it's called when things smack into each other. There wasn't even any damage, unless you count the flotation devices bursting. But you should definitely count that, because without your floats, your ship sinks like a stone. Down, 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 into the murky depths. You're still not worried, since you can always just fly the ship right back up to the surface. Except that when you hit bottom, the engines go dead. You try to restart them with no success. Fortunately, your spacesuit is watertight and more than capable of protecting you from the water pressure that would otherwise crush you like a soda can. It'll have to do. You're gonna have to swim for it. You gather up your seed pod, head to the airlock, turn on the lights in your suit, and hope for the best. Well, this is a first. You're standing on the door of the airlock. Usually you're firmly rooted to the floor, and the door is just as firmly set in the wall, or else you're floating weightlessly and there is no real up or down. But the ship landed at an odd angle, and you're not quite sure what to expect when you open the doors. If there isn't enough room for you to crawl out between the door and the ocean bottom, you're in some serious trouble. The wall, or now floor, is festooned with a big blue button, which opens the door. Festooned means adorned. Adorned means decorated. You push the button. You've had a couple of experiences with explosive decompression, where you open up the airlock door and the rush of escaping air blows you out into space. This time the rush of water flooding into the airlock smashes you up into the ceiling. Or at least now it's the ceiling, it used to be the back wall. Luckily, your suit's able to cushion the blow. Soon the airlock is full of water and you're able to swim out the door, which closes behind you. At first you're confused. You'd expected the ocean bottom to be centimeters from the open door. Instead you drift down, down, ever down, and when your feet do finally touch something solid, it isn't the silt of the bottom of the sea, but a stone floor. You look up, hoping to see a glimmer of the surface. Instead, you find a stone ceiling, far too high above your head to reach. And right where you might expect to find a chandelier, you see the blinking blue lights around the outside of your ship's airlock through the hole it made upon impact. You have crashed into an undersea castle. Moldy stone walls stand all around you, dimly visible through the murk. You feel them more than see them. Chunks of fallen stone from the ceiling lie scattered around at your feet. You can barely make out arched doorways at either end of the room. Also at your feet is the seed pod. You lost track of it in the rush of water. You scoop it up. You go to the north, into the keep. A fortified tower inside the castle walls. Fortified means strengthened. A stone spiral staircase leads upward, but stops abruptly when it reaches the ceiling. So you go the other way, into a great empty chamber just like the one you landed in, except for a long stone slab that you decide must be a dining table. You don't have any evidence for this. You don't know how this castle got here, or who might have lived in it. For all you know, they might have been incredibly tall, skinny, water-breathing creatures, and this was one of their beds. But for the time being, we'll call it a dining table. Beyond that is a room just as big as the others you've seen. But unlike the others, this one contains a barnacle-encrusted object in the unmistakable shape of a chair. Given the place you found it and the fact that it's built into the floor, you can only conclude that it must be a throne. The far wall features a carved-out alcove that looks like it must have been a fireplace. Though how one might go about lighting a fire underwater is anyone's guess. Mounted on the wall above the fireplace, in an X shape, are a pickaxe and a shovel. You try to get the pickaxe, but it clings firmly to the wall. You tug on it again, and this time the handle moves a few centimeters. Then you feel a distinct click. The castle begins to rumble, with the shaking most pronounced in the direction of the keep. The shovel, which was wedged behind the pickaxe, clatters to the ground, and the rumbling stops. After that, the pickaxe swings back into place. You get the shovel, then head back to the keep, where the stone spiral staircase now leads upward to the ocean's surface. You start up the stairs, the murk gradually diminishing as you come closer and closer to the surface. But just as the sun starts to resolve from a general glow into a specific bright blob above you, a vicious rip current pulls you off the staircase and drags you further out to sea. The sheer power of the current throws you for a loop. You thrash in vain against it, crying out in frustration as your muscles begin to cramp from the effort while you continue to be dragged further and further out to sea. Finally, you try swimming parallel to shore, and that frees you from the current's grip. For several long moments, you drift aimlessly in the ocean, exhausted. When you do at last get your wind back and take your bearings, you find yourself kilometers from the nearest hint of land. Sighing, you start for shore. Your suit feels unexpectedly cumbersome, but you dare not take it off. Even if it does make you tire that much faster, at least you don't risk drowning. Or rather, you don't risk drowning until your oxygen supply runs out. Luckily, this doesn't happen until your feet at long last touch the shore. You drag yourself onto the beach, blinding spots dancing before your eyes. Your knees give even as you tear off your helmet, and everything goes dark. Everything is dark. No matter how much you strain your eyes, you can't see the faintest hint of light. But whispering voices tickle the edge of your hearing. Level of 0.15. Long distance call to Ascension. Frat boy is completely uninjured. The husband has an excellent chance of... At least she didn't suffer. The vending machine ate my dollar. Light flickers before your eyes. At first you don't see anything familiar. And then suddenly Linda is there at your side. You are in a hospital bed. What? What? You start to ask? Shh, Linda says. You need to save your strength. The doctors say you'll be fine, but it'll take some time. She... Ow. The effort to speak becomes too much, and you have to rest for a moment. How? For a moment, Linda seems confused. Then she realizes what you're asking, and shakes her head sadly. And suddenly the room seems colder. Gold. The sand is curiously cold against your face as you wake up, the waves licking at the soles of your boots. Cold and hard, more like gravel or even cobblestone than sand. As you lift your head and look around, you notice something else wrong. The sand is the wrong color. It's darker, more metallic. A It's gold. You are on the southern end of a golden beach, a glittering crescent nestled between the crashing ocean to the east and towering cliffs to the west, ankle-deep in gold. You run your hands through it, rings, coins, nuggets, and gold dust. Drifting down from the sky, collecting in dunes, the dust is everywhere. You run your hands through your hair and your gloves come out looking like they belong to a statuette. To your relief, your seed pod is washed up onto the beach in excellent condition, though the container it was in is nowhere to be found. And though you thought you'd lost it a long way from shore, your shovel is here too. You walk along the golden beach and find something wooden buried in the sand at your feet, but it's buried so deeply that only a corner of it is visible. You use your shovel and dig for a few minutes and seem to be making good progress when suddenly the handle of the shovel snaps off. Apparently all that time underwater weakened it after all. Luckily, you no longer need it. You've done enough digging that you're able to grab the wooden object and pull it loose. It's a treasure chest, a tiny one, and what's more, it doesn't seem to be locked. Opening the chest reveals dirt. Someone must have found this very precious. Which makes sense. It was buried in a place where gold was everywhere, and so wasn't especially valuable. Dirt, on the other hand, seems to be quite rare around here. Since it's so scarce, it's worth keeping safe. You take the chest and keep walking along the golden beach. You see a pass to the northwest, with something shiny visible through the gap in the cliffs. So you take one last look at the golden beach and stride off through the pass. You take one last look at the hockey game on TV and stride through the garage door to tell Allie it's time to come in. You walk through your garage, which was supposed to be a two-car, but with the trash cans, your workbench, Allie's bike, and all the rest of the junk that's taken up residence in the place, you're lucky to be able to even squeeze just the Volvo in here. You head out into the front yard, and one of the advantages of living on the outskirts of town is that you are able to get a house with a little bit of land around it. Which isn't to say that you have to walk a kilometer to get to your neighbor's house, just that you can actually take a few steps outside your door and not be on anyone else's property. Allie is sprawled on the front lawn, gazing up at the stars. "Hi, Daddy," she says. "Hey, how come the night sky is dark? I mean, with all the stars in the universe, if you look in any direction, wouldn't you eventually see a star?" Allie is your only child. 9 years old, beautiful, extremely bright and inquisitive.
Sunday nights, nice for hospitals and homes, answering the phone.
When she gets going with the questions, it's next to impossible to shut her up, which is exactly the way you like it. When you were growing up, you were told that children were to be seen and not heard. And you vowed that any kids you might have were going to be seen as much as they wanted to be seen and heard as much as they wanted to be heard. The fact that Allie is, in your unbiased opinion, the most brilliant kid in the history of the universe and a joy to listen to is just an added bonus. Well, you say, people used to think it was because there were only a few stars, and that they were just tiny points of light set in the outermost of a set of crystalline spheres that surrounded the Earth. Crystalline just means like a crystal. There were a whole bunch of these spheres, nestled inside of one another. I think the moon was closest, then Mercury, then Venus, then the sun, then Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, then the stars, and outside of that was heaven. So how does it really work? Allie asks. Mary thinks it's a little strange that you've started choosing introductory astrophysics texts as your bedtime reading material, but it really pays off at moments like this. Well, you say, lying down on the grass next to Allie. It has to do with the inverse square law. Think of a star and imagine putting up an enormous sheet of paper about one astronomical unit away. The star will light up a certain area of the sheet of paper. Now take that paper and put it 2 astronomical units away. The area that the star lights up will be twice as tall and twice as wide, but it's the same amount of light hitting it, the same number of photons, only spread out over an area 4 times as big. That means if you look at a small area of the sheet of paper, only 1/4 as many photons are hitting it, so it looks 1/4 as bright. If you look at it from 10 times as far away, it looks 1/100 as bright. That means that the further away you get, the fewer photons have a chance of reaching your eyes. And if you factor in all the things that can block the photons that do have a chance to get here, clouds of hydrogen gas, for instance, only the photons from the closest and brightest stars make it to your eyes. The rest of the sky looks dark. Cool, Allie says. Is that true about everything a star sends out, or just light? Well, you say, a star doesn't emit a whole lot except light, if by light you mean photons, which can range anywhere from radio waves to X-rays and beyond. Then there's the solar wind, which is mostly protons. And then there are neutrinos, which go through pretty much everything. People have collected huge pools of gallium, put them deep underground, and it turns out that 30 tons of the stuff, 30 tons, will catch one neutrino a day. The neutrino will turn one atom of gallium into germanium. All the other billions and billions of neutrinos just go streaming right through the Earth. But you can't see them, because they go right through your eyes. Awesome, Allie says. Where does the gallium come from? Good question, you say. The easy answer is that it's mined. But here's the more interesting answer. You know what a star is, right? Sure, Allie says. It's a big ball of hydrogen being fused into helium. Bing, you say, right as usual. Now, eventually, the hydrogen runs out. What happens to the helium left over? Some of it gets expelled out into space, and the rest of it contracts even tighter, till the helium starts to fuse. So the star lights up again, turning helium into carbon, and then into oxygen. And the process keeps going. Some of the matter is expelled into space, the rest keeps contracting, fusing into neon, magnesium, silicon, and eventually into iron. Iron is pretty much the most stable thing there is. Right now, hydrogen is the most common substance there is, but if you wait long enough, it'll be iron. Now, iron is element number 26, and gallium is number 31, so you'll never get to gallium that way. Heavy elements like gallium or gold are produced in supernovae. They're formed when stars explode and fly out into space. Really? Gold, Allie says? It just comes raining down out of space? Maybe indirectly, you say. See, the newly formed heavy elements fly out into space and collect in gravity wells and start clumping together. Some end up inside new second or third generation stars, while others get locked up in planets only to get dug up a few billion years later and used for neutrino detection or jewelry or coins. Of course, gold is used in coins because it's valuable, and it's valuable because it's rare, and it's rare because, well, to a certain extent, it's the luck of the draw. If you look at a chart of the elements in the Earth's crust, it turns out iridium and the elements around it are rarer than you might expect. Right after iridium is platinum, which is very precious, and after that is gold, which is just slightly more common and just slightly less precious. But if you look at meteorites, you find that they're not lacking in iridium the way the Earth is. Meteorites are loaded with this stuff, and they've got even more platinum. So it's easy to imagine that there are planets out there where there just so happened to be a lot of gold and platinum in the area of space where the planet was formed, and so they're considered common, while something else, zirconium maybe, is considered really valuable. I've heard of iridium before, Allie says. Isn't there a lot of it in the layer of the Earth's crust that comes from right when all the dinosaurs died out? I remember reading something like that. That's right, you say. That's usually counted as evidence that it was a meteorite impact that led to them all dying off. Not that the iridium killed them, but that iridium is a sign that there was a big meteorite around that time, and it's easy to see how a big impact could lead to massive die-offs. But that's also an important thing to keep in mind when you think about this stuff. One bit of pure gold is exactly the same as any other bit of pure gold. The substance behaves the same way. So from one point of view, any particular piece of gold isn't valuable at all, since you can always get another. You can even replace your iridium. But, Michael Crichton notwithstanding, you can't get back any of the dinosaurs. You're not made of a whole lot that's particularly exotic. The only stuff heavier than iron, the only things you'd need a supernova for, are trace elements. A little iodine to keep the goiter away, that kind of thing. You're made mainly of the most common star stuff. Carbon, oxygen, hydrogen. But you can't just trade yourself in for a sack of carbon and oxygen and hydrogen the way you can trade gold for gold. What makes you you is the way that star stuff is arranged, and that's totally unique. Which makes you more valuable than all the gold from all the stars in the sky. And what am I, chopped liver? Mary asks, emerging from the garage. All the stars in the sky? Really, Sam, when you start trying to wax poetic, it's a pretty good sign that it's past your bedtime, let alone Allie's. Time to come in, kids. Okay, Mom, Allie says. She stands up and stretches. Night, Daddy. Good night, honey, you say. Sweet dreams. As you follow her inside, you pause to take a quick look at the sky yourself. It's certainly pretty, but it's been a long time since you were as enraptured by it as Allie seems to be. You can't help but feel a little sad about that. Sky blue. As you walk through the pass, you encounter first one shard of glass on the ground, then another. But it isn't until you crest the final hill that you see what you've discovered. You are standing on a ridge above the entrance to a vast crystal labyrinth. You'd be tempted to call it a city, with its haphazard collection of iridescent towers and spires and arches. Iridescent means shimmering with rainbow colors. But from what you can see from your vantage point, there's barely enough space between the crystal walls to permit one person to pass between them. The labyrinth is ringed by steep mountains, so going around it is impossible. You step into the crystal labyrinth and immediately get lost. As you wander, you see that two of the nearby walls intersect to form the base of an immense spire. You walk further and further, past an enormous arch which looms overhead. You
continue to walk until, with an audible sputter, the cooling unit of your spacesuit finally gives out. You remove the suit and drop it on the ground before you continue walking. You walk and walk until you feel a cool breeze ruffle the feathers of your wings. Your wings are a little sore from having been bound up in your spacesuit for so long. You stretch your wings and soar into the sky. Now you're hovering above the crystal labyrinth. From this perspective, it looks like a mind-bogglingly complex mandala. A mandala is a pattern that some people use in prayer. There's no way you could have possibly navigated it on the ground. In fact, it almost gives you a headache. Much more relaxing is the cloudless, sparkling blue sky all around you. A bird flies by, disappearing through the gap in the mountains to the west. You follow it, flying through the pass, reveling in the rush of the wind against your white feathered wings. She's an angel. She's an absolute angel. No, can't think like that. She's just a kid like any other kid. Completely approachable. Puts her pants on one leg at a time like anyone else. Oh, bad move. Should not have thought about her putting on pants. Concentrate, focus, power, eye of the tiger, wax on, wax off. Wait, that's not right. Come on, don't overthink this. Just go in and ask her. Hey, Allie, what's up? Wanna go to the dance with me? Easy as that. What's the worst that could happen? Well, you could wet your pants. Funny how it always comes back to pants. You walk into the gym. The Queensport Middle School gym is usually rather damp and dingy, but right now is festooned with colorful balloons and streamers in preparation for the big dance Friday night. You look around and there, far above your head, is Allie, glowing like a star. Or maybe that's just from standing in front of the spotlight rigged to the ceiling. She's balanced on a tall ladder, draping streamers from the rafters. Her colleagues on the Student Activities Committee, Joyce and Cheryl, are standing around a helium tank, filling balloons and letting them float up to the ceiling. Allie looks down at you as you come in. Hey, John, she says, can you turn off that light for me? It's burning kind of hot. Allie Dawson is the smartest, nicest, most beautiful girl in your class. Also in the country, probably in the world. Honestly, though, you're probably just setting yourself up for some serious embarrassment. She's not going to go to the dance with you. She's probably secretly seeing some movie star or something. Maybe you should just go. You turn the light off. Thanks, Sally says. That about does it for the streamers. She climbs back down the ladder, digs around in her backpack, and pulls out an orange. Want one? She asks. No, that's okay, you say. So, we get along okay, huh? You ask. Remember in kindergarten when I traded you my juice box for your pudding snack? That was pretty cool, right? Joyce and Cheryl snicker, but Allie seems not at all put off by the stupidity of what you've just said. Sure, she says. You take a deep breath.
It doesn't take, so you try it again. Well, you say, so, I was just kind of wondering whether maybe if you weren't doing anything or weren't already going, whether you might want to go to the dance with me if you want. I mean, it's no big deal or anything. It's up to you. I just thought, you know, why not? There, you think. That was pretty smooth. But Allie shakes her head. Sorry, she says. I'm babysitting that night. Your heart plummets into your stomach with what you're sure is an audible splash. You're trying to decide whether to throw yourself in front of the nearest bus or if you should just go home and slash your wrists when you realize Allie isn't finished talking. So it'll have to be Saturday, she concludes. Wait, what? So that's a yes? Sure, she says. I mean, it won't be a dance, but I'm sure we can find something fun to do. Can you come by around 7? Saturday, 7 o'clock, 75 hours, 43 minutes, 17 seconds from now. Suddenly, it seems like a lifetime. You're driving down Bartlett Hill Road, and as you pass Allie's school, you can't help but notice that the message board outside says, Dance Friday, gym, 6 to 10 p.m. There was a dance tonight, you ask? You should have told us, we could have found another sitter. That's okay, Allie says drowsily. You and Miss Mackay asked before any boys did. Well, still, you say. Next time, just call us and give us the old heave-ho, okay? I'm sure there must be a legion of boys out there who cried themselves to sleep thanks to us. Allie smiles sleepily. You sound like my dad, she says. Allie and your daughter Wendy struck up a friendship a couple summers back, when the teacher of Wendy's swimming class brought in some of the kids from her youth league team to help out. Since then, Allie's been your regular babysitter. She's bright, polite, doesn't charge very much, and Wendy likes her enough that her first question whenever you and Linda get home from an outing is when you'll be going out again. You cruise through the Polk Boulevard intersection. How is it that I sound like your dad, you ask? Allie says. It's just that when you were talking about legions of boys crying themselves to sleep, it reminded me of how my dad's always telling me, you're at the age now where you're gonna have to deal with droves of grubby little boys vying for your attention. Just want to warn you that I'm bound to show an inordinate amount of glee with every heart that you break. Why is that, you ask? Well, Allie says, when I asked him, he said that it's like Freud said. The parent of the powerless sex always longs to have a child of the powerful sex. Then he told me, and sure enough, after years of having to deal with being on the receiving end of possible rejection every time I was interested in someone, it's gonna be a thrill to see my very own kid dishing it out. It's a clear case of Venus envy. You go over the train tracks and through the O'Brien Boulevard intersection. You know, Wendy's crazy about you, you say. We take her to buy clothes, she wants to dress like you. We take her to get her hair cut, she wants it done like yours. And every time you come over, she spends the next couple of days throwing around words like conquistador and geosynchronous. When she gets an 800 on her verbal SAT, we'll know who to thank. Well, when I was her age, I hated it when people talked down to me, Allie shrugs. So it'd be hypocritical of me to talk down to her. You cruise through the Nelson Boulevard intersection. Wow, all the lights seem to be green this evening. I hate to ask you to come over twice in less than a week, you say, but are you free to look after Wendy on Thursday? If not, please just say the word. We can find someone else. I don't want to keep you from hanging out with kids your own age. Ah, sure, it's no problem, Allie says. I don't mind, really. I like spending time with Wendy. Most of my friends are either significantly younger or significantly older than me anyhow. You enter the Montgomery Boulevard intersection and are blindsided by a car screaming down the road with its lights off at 100 kilometers an hour, maybe more. The impact caves in the passenger side door and sends the car spinning wildly, the air thick with smoke and the acrid smell of burnt rubber, Allie's blood hot against your face, and as you black out, you catch a glimpse of the light. And it was green. It was green. It was green. screen. On the other side of the pass, you find yourself flying over a vast forest that stretches as far as you can see. The mere sight of it is enough to make your wings ache. There's no way you can fly that far under your own power. Besides, the idea of strolling through a shady forest seems awfully appealing right about now. You touch down and wander through the woods. After a few minutes of walking through the forest, you reach a small clearing and pause to take a look around. Something is wrong. In fact, everything is just slightly off. The leaves of the trees don't sway enough in the breeze. The subtle sounds of the forest are conspicuously absent. Everything smells sterile and dead. But you can't quite put your finger on why that is. As you look more closely at the trees, you suddenly realize what's wrong with them. They're not alive. The trunks and branches of the trees are solid stone, petrified wood, the organic material replaced with silica from the groundwater over the course of millions of years. Silica is silicon dioxide, which makes up sand, quartz, all kinds of things. But these are not mere stone pillars. They're still trees, complete with leaves made of malachite, a green marbled stone derived from copper and as arresting in its own way as emerald. Arresting means it makes you stop and look. You don't have much time to ponder this mystery, because suddenly you hear a growling in the distance and turn to see a wolf charging right at you. The wolf bounds closer. It looks as though it's about to leap for your throat. But then it knocks you to the ground and starts playfully licking your face. You pet it, then get up and gather your possessions, the wolf trotting merrily along at your heels. The wolf looks rather emaciated. Emaciated means scrawny from lack of food. Someone needs to feed it. You open your treasure chest and dump the dirt on the ground. Then you plant the seed pod in the dirt, step back, and wait for it to grow. But nothing happens. You hear a soft chuckling behind you. "Well, well," says a voice, "if it ain't pirate-turned-astronaut Wendy Mackay, what are you doing in the Queen's realms?" You turn around to find a diminutive man with a bushy white beard, pushing along a white cart almost as big as he is. Diminutive is another word for small. "Who are you?" you ask. "I'm the local weather salesman," he says, "and I'd say that you're not going to have much success growing things without some rain handy." He rummages through his cart. "But you're in luck," he says. "I just happen to have some in stock." You ask him if you can buy some rain. The salesman says. "Normally I ask for a gold piece, but it looks as though you have enough of the stuff in your hair for me to change my price." He reaches into his cart and pulls out a comb. "What say ye?" You run your fingers through your hair and they come out golden. Apparently it collected quite a bit of gold dust while you were wandering around on the beach. "Fair enough," you say. You sit down on the ground and the weather salesman goes to work with his comb. A few moments later, he gleefully puts two handfuls of gold dust in his cart. Then you stand up and he snaps his fingers. A tiny cloud appears at knee level, raining a trickle of water onto the planted pod. You start to complain, but suddenly there's no one to complain to. The salesman is gone without a trace. And in the end, it doesn't matter. Even this tiny rainstorm does its job. Shortly after the cloud dissipates, the pod shudders, and a full-grown shrubbery erupts from inside, loaded with deep red berries and bright green leaves. The wolf starts nibbling at the berries, first tentatively, then with relish. And with the berries springing forth from the bush as fast as the wolf can eat them, it seems pretty clear that the wolf isn't going to starve to death after all. So while it looks as though you won't have anything from the Red Planet to hand over to headquarters once you get home,
You have saved a life. And that's the end of our story for tonight, Allie says.
What? That can't be the end. There's still so much you don't know. Like, how do you get home? Are you even on the right planet? Do you get in trouble for not having the pod anymore? Who's the queen the weather salesman talked about? But wait, you begin, what about...
Come on, Wendy, Allie says, you know the rules. It's way past your bedtime. Your parents will be home soon, and if you're still up, it won't look too good for either of us.
I'll be right here if you need anything.
She pulls a book out of her backpack and starts in on her homework. Allie is your regular babysitter, but she doesn't just throw a TV dinner at you and make you go to bed at 6. She tells you stories, and helps you with your homework, and lets you help cook, and tells you which boys she likes, and all in all, acts like a friend. A friend who's older and smarter and more beautiful than you could ever be, but still a friend. You close your eyes and try to force yourself to sleep, but it's just no use. You have to find out about the Queen and the rest of the mission. You ask Allie about how you get home.
You'll find out next time, Allie says, smiling. Or maybe I'll play you and you can tell me what happens, depending on what I choose to do.
But who is the Queen, you ask?
The Queen, Allie says. She puts down her pencil. I guess I did slip that in there, didn't I?
She flashes a bittersweet smile.
Well, all the settings from that story came from these weird dreams I've been having lately, she says.
Then there's one more. One I haven't told you about. You sure you want to hear about this?
Yeah, you say.
Okay, Allie says. It starts like this. Purple. I open my eyes and I am in a cold, dim, lonely place. I blink, thinking my eyes are still closed, but then I realize that it's not pitch black. There's a dark purple fog billowing all around me, so close to black as to make nearly no difference. There's a faint purple glow to the stone floor, though I might not even notice it if it weren't holding me up. I try to find my way out of this place, but no matter which direction I try, or however far I go, it's all the same. Eventually, maybe it's minutes, maybe it's days, I can suddenly make out a vague shape in the fog. It's strange because parts of it look distinctly human, but others are just as clearly not. I come closer, and I discover the answer. It's a person sitting in a huge throne made of rock. No, that's not right. It's not made of rock. It is a rock. One single stone in the rough shape of a high-backed chair. Her face is turned away from me, but I can tell that it's a young woman, dressed in long, flowing purple garments. Dressed in royal purple, sitting in a throne, I can only assume that she's a queen or princess of some sort.
Since I don't believe in monarchy, and certainly am not one of her subjects, I don't feel the need to bow or scrape or call her your majesty. Hello, I say. After a moment, she turns to face me. That's when I start to get really scared. She has my face. She's a lot older. She's got to be at least 20. But there can be no mistake. I'm talking to myself. Normally, this would be a sign of impending mental collapse, but luckily, it's already a dream. Well, she says, aren't you going to flee in terror? Can't you feel the life seeping out of you already just by being near me? I ask her why I should be scared. Why should you be scared, she asks. Now I suppose you wouldn't know. Not yet. You're new here. But I suppose I might as well confess. See, I'm one of those girls with a rep. Everything I look at is supposed to die. And it's true. I am the queen of all I survey, and all I survey is long dead. But here's the part that no one believes. It was like that when I got here. When I arrived here, I was given proprietorship over all the realms I had dreamt of as a child, she says. But those were all places from which life had long since fled. Barren planets and crumbling castles, forests of stone and vacant crystal cities. Worlds upon worlds that were mine, all mine. But not a bit of it populated by any living thing. Sure, the occasional fish or fowl might wander through, but any creature that enters my domain either dies or leaves me. Nothing ever stays. I decide to say nothing. The last thing she needs after what she just said is me asking the way to the nearest exit. No, the queen says, by all means, go. Go. You'll be back soon enough. You see, she says, I remember this conversation from the other direction.
We're home, you announce.
Wendy, what are you still doing up?
Sorry, Miss Mackay, says Allie, the sitter. It's my fault. Our bedtime story sort of segued into a conversation about these dreams I've been having. I shouldn't have kept her up this late.
Well, at least it's not a school night, you say. No harm done, I guess. Jim's waiting in the car, so you probably ought to get out there. And as for you, Miss Wendy, you need to get to sleep, pronto.
Kiss, Wendy cries.
All right, you begin, but Wendy shakes her head.
I mean Allie, she says.
Allie flashes you an embarrassed smile and kisses Wendy on the cheek. Good night, kiddo, she says. Hope your dreams are sweeter than mine. You thank Allie for babysitting.
Sure, no problem, Allie says. I enjoy it.
Allie finishes stuffing her books in her backpack and puts it on.
Okay, see you soon, she says.
You follow her out to the garage door. Jim's car is waiting in the driveway. and as she walks toward it, she's swallowed up in the glare of the headlights. Pure white light blazes down on Allie's crib as Sam plugs in the huge screen he ordered through the mail and mounted on the ceiling. Allie rubs her eyes. "What is that thing?" you ask. "Just a fluorescent light?" "Not at all," Sam says. "The Photopia is a low-energy, high-intensity LCD screen with a bunch of different settings." He tosses you the remote. "Just push the white button to cycle through them." Sam is your husband, who has lately taken to ordering all kinds of strange things through the mail. Today it was the Photopia, the day before that it was some kind of baby-safe blender. Tomorrow it'll be a bag of llama feed or something. You push the white button, and the Photopia suddenly goes dark. But not completely dark. Instead, it displays a field of stars, as if it were a skylight. Allie blinks and regards it curiously. "There's more," Sam says. "Hit the button again. There's another mode that's even better." You push the button and the screen changes once again. This time it shows a black field over which three large circles, one red, one blue, one green, slowly drift. They bounce off the sides of the screen, but when they collide, they blend to form other colors: magenta, cyan, yellow, white. Allie claps with delight. "I think we have a winner," Sam grins. "Money well spent," says I. "Okay, I know one little kid who's up way past her bedtime. Can you get the lights on?" You glance into the crib as your hand rests on the light switch. "Good night, Allie," you say. "Sleep well." You turn out the light. Photopia by Adam Kadre.